Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is podcast episode 67, and this is for today, Tuesday, December 20th, 2011. Today, we're going to do things a little bit different. We have a compilation of articles. We're going to start this out with the first article that appeared on BadQuaker.com. It's called Waffle People or Why Everything You Know About Anarchism May Be Wrong. Then after that, we're going to delve into theology a little bit. But rest assured, everything, hopefully, that is portrayed in these articles should be acceptable to everyone, no matter your theology or lack thereof. So if you hear something that you're not quite comfortable with, religiously or non-religiously speaking, stick with it for a minute, and you might find out that it's adaptable to either or any set of beliefs, because it's based more on human principles of humanity and less on a specific belief or non-belief. So after the Waffle People, we will have an article called A General Theory of Liberty, Tyranny, and Sin. Then we're going to have the article My Natural Progression from Libertarian Theist to Quaker. And then the article One Difference Between a Conservative, a Liberal, and a Libertarian. And we're going to finish off our set with an article named How Much Tax is Morally Justifiable? So here we go. Here is Waffle People. Side note to today's article. The following article was the first article that was published at BadQuaker.com. The reason that the staff at BadQuaker.com decided to start the website with that article is because it's about how confused people can be with the concepts of anarchism. And this includes people who call themselves anarchists. And this is not condemning anyone, and this is not trying to divide anyone. It's simply pointing out that there are fundamental aspects that make a person an anarchist. And there are a lot of people who think they're anarchists who don't have the slightest clue as to what those fundamental principles are. And there are a lot of other people who hear the word anarchist, and things jump into their mind that are entirely false. And when I'm saying anarchism, I'm speaking specifically of anarcho-capitalism, because pretty much every other kind of anarchism, and there are all kinds of flavors and types, but they all dissolve when you start to break them down into their fundamental core. But anarcho-capitalism is specifically what we're talking about here. So as you hear this article, consider that the point is that the vast majority of people who think they know what an anarcho-capitalist is are fundamentally confused about the basic facts. Waffle People, or Why Everything You Know About Anarchism May Be Wrong, by Ben Stone. Once upon a time, in a land not so very far away, there was a very happy kingdom called Wavels. Wavels had a wise, kind old king who was beloved by his people. The kingdom was located among steep mountains and was naturally guarded on every approach by towering cliffs. The people always felt safe, since there was but one heavily guarded pass leading into Wavels, and it had never been conquered. Because of its remoteness, very few people ever visited or even knew about Wavels. One day a traveler was wandering in the mountains and came upon the pass leading to Wavels. He saw that the road was seldom used and decided it would be a good path to take and learn about new places. The traveler was a happy, healthy man, not known for his intelligence, but loved by his friends for his good cheer and his simple honesty. He made his way past the checkpoints unaccosted, since he didn't present any danger in the eyes of the guards, and once through the pass, a wide valley stretched out before him with a village in the distance. When the traveler reached the village, he spotted the town cobbler, who was in front of his shop showing off a new pair of tall black boots that he had just finished. The cobbler happened to be eating a thin rolled waffle filled with fruit and cream, and had just taken a huge bite. "What is this land, and by what name is this village known, friend?" said the traveler to the cobbler. The cobbler, with his mouth still occupied with his lunch, said, "It's waffles." The traveler misunderstood the man to say waffles, and assumed he had not been clear with his question. Not the treat. The land, my friend. What's the name of this land, this kingdom? Again, the cobbler tried to speak with food in his mouth.
Waffles. Kingdom of waffles and the land of waffles.
Unfortunately, having never heard the word waffles, the traveler assumed the man was saying waffles. Funny name for a village or a land, the traveler mumbled, and again, with his stuffed mouth, the cobbler said,
"It's our dear king's name as well, good King Waffles, rest his soul."
But at this point, the traveler was only half listening. He had spotted an old lady drawing water from a well, and decided to try to engage a conversation with someone who didn't have a mouthful of food. Now, it just so happened that the day before, the good king had died, and as was the custom, the new king wouldn't be crowned until after the old king was cremated. The traveler walked up to the old woman at the well and asked, "Dear woman, can you help me? I'm confused about this king of yours and your land." The old lady shook her head and said, "Bless him, the king's not living. Don't you know?" The traveler was more confused than ever. "Here now, I'm confused. Am I to understand your king is a waffle?" She almost laughed at his foreign pronunciation. "Our king is a waffle. He was the son of a waffle, and the next king will be a waffle as well." So, having completely misunderstood every bit of information that had been passed to him, the traveler filled his jug with water and bought some provisions and began to leave the land of waffles, or waffles, as he understood it to be. As he left town, he noticed strands of black cloth hanging from windows and from eaves. Odd, he hadn't noticed that before. Looking up the hill, he spotted the castle with black flags waving at every parapet. Just down the hill a bit, people were stacking wood in a great mound. The traveler stood gawking for a moment, trying to take in what he saw, when another villager said to him,
"Makes a fellow want to cry, don't it?"
What's that?" said the traveler.
"Well, it's just that I love the old man. I hate to see them burn him like that. I know it's the way, but it doesn't seem proper to me, is all. I just hate to see him burn."
"They burn their elderly?" thought the traveler. "I must leave this land with all haste." After some time, the traveler made it back to his own land and to his own village. Day after day, he would go to the local pub and tell the stories of his travels. Exotic, faraway lands with strange animals, people of different skin tones and various cultures, strange foods and odd spices, interesting buildings were described in every detail by the traveler. But the one story that always finished the night, the one everyone waited for, after a long hours of talk and drink, was the story of the Waffle People. Everyone loved the story of the Waffle People. These odd folk that waved black flags and wore big black boots and euthanized the old, and they ate waffles, but they not only ate waffles, they sat a waffle on a throne and bowed to him as their king. Talk about these strange people would continue even after the traveler gave up for the night and went home. Late at night, with more and more drinks flowing, the story of the Waffle People would grow and take on new oddities, and the story would twist in every direction as others would say they, too, had heard of the Waffle Land and these strange Waffle People and the Waffle on a Throne. As the traveler aged, his memory slipped, and more he relied on the folks at the pub to help him with his stories. Eventually, the old gent passed on, but the story of the Waffle People continued to grow. Yes, it was known that in Waffle Land, everyone wore big black boots. Men and women alike wore these boots. Actually, men and women dressed alike, all in black from their heads to their toe. In the midst of these wild speculations, someone pointed out that pirates on the high sea often use black flags. Others said, black flag is a sign of plague. Could it be that pirates, infected with some mind-altering plague, had taken refuge in the mountains? Eventually, specific facts about Waffle Land and the evil Waffle People became common knowledge. Namely, Waffle People
were a race descended from pirates infected by an illness that twists the mind. They lived in a village where every house was made of waffles. They kill off their old as soon as they reach the age of 30 years. The only food they eat is waffles, and they drink a strange brew made of waffles and the ashes of their dead elders. They worship an idol of their god king, the Great Waffle, set in a huge black hall covered in black tapestries. Only one man has ever set foot in Waffle Land and come out alive, and he was driven to madness and drank himself to death over what he saw there. As new generations heard and passed on the lore of the Waffle people, different people reacted in different ways. An odd little traveling holy man ranted about the evils of waffles in general. Teenagers took to wearing black garb. Black boots became all the rage among the young. Mothers worried about their children, and old men talked about how the waffles were corrupting society. Watchmen at night would occasionally sound the alarm, thinking they had seen a waffle lurking in the darkness. Now, to be honest, some people knew that this whole Waffle Land was a huge misunderstanding. The local magistrate often laughed at the silly, uneducated hordes with their foolish superstitions. He and the high priest discussed how handy it was to have the waffles around. For example, when it was found that the coinage had been debased and only worth about a third of its perceived value, it wasn't hard for the village to believe that the waffles were working among them to rob them of their wealth with counterfeit coins. Of course, the magistrate solved the problem by confiscating all the coins and replacing it with official script. Then there was the time that the cathedral was robbed of the relief fund that had been gathered for the poor. Anyone could see the hand of the waffles in such a deed. It was a good thing that the magistrate stepped up with the emergency relief tax. Otherwise, the poor would have starved that winter. For the protection of the village, some new laws were enacted. First and foremost, no wearing of boots or any black cloth. No making or buying, selling, or possessing waffles or waffle-making devices. And lastly, worship of the Great Waffle was strictly forbidden under penalty of death. Even with these carefully crafted laws, things seemed to be getting worse and worse. Young people began openly defying authority, wearing their black boots, and even waving black flags. Sometimes groups of young wafflers would knock over waste bins and set haystacks on fire. It was about this time another of the villagers decided he wished to travel and see strange places. Traveling from place to place, he was careful to avoid the Black Pass that was the legendary entrance to Waffle. After a while, he decided to return home, so taking the most direct route, he came almost too near to the entrance of the pass. And there he saw an old man pushing a wagon in the direction of the evil pass, so he shouted at him, "Hey there, stop! What? Are you a stranger to these lands? Worse than death awaits you if you go on that road." The man stopped and asked, "Here now, of what do you speak?" The traveler told the tale to the old fellow, faithful to all the details that he was so sure of. "That's silly nonsense, young man. How did you come to have such notions?" The traveler explained again the evils of these waffle people. "I'm telling you that's nonsense. First off, it's not waffles, it's waffles. I happen to be a waffle on my mother's side and live there near half my life." But the traveler would hear none of it. In his mind, he knew what he believed was right, and no matter what the old man said, it wouldn't change what the traveler believed. Well, this has been a long story, and you're likely asking yourself why you've read this far. If you're a libertarian or consider yourself an anarcho-capitalist, you've likely already seen the comparison. Then again, maybe it's not so obvious. When a liberty-loving anarchist or libertarian talks to pretty much anyone outside of our movement, we can almost be certain they have a preconceived notion of who we are and what we stand for that's every bit as wrong and twisted as the picture painted of the Wavells by the fools in the story above. Terminology has systematically been twisted by a combination of ignorance, happen chance, and the concentrated efforts of evil people so that we're virtually guaranteed to be misunderstood by the hordes. Lies abound, and accusations of assassinations, wars, bombings, and mayhem have all been falsely attributed to us, and these lies have been told so often and with such conviction that some of us have even believed them at times. Sadly, the vast majority of Americans today have no interest in learning the truth about us or about liberty, and many who say they're with us are only in it for the cool boots. After all, at the moment, we're a bit of a fashion craze. But that will pass with time, and we'll simply be misunderstood again soon. This is the ethical foundation that all of liberty is based on. The philosophy of non-aggression, the initiation of physical force against persons or property, the threat of such, or fraud upon persons or property, is unethical when done by a single person or by a group. Right of property. Each person is the exclusive owner of his or her body, life, and actions, and is exclusively responsible for their body, life, and actions. Each person owns the product of their labor and any previously unowned resource that they acquire or improve, homestead. A person may use, improve, destroy, sell, trade, or give as a gift any item that they rightfully own. A person owns what they have homesteaded, purchased, traded for, or were rightfully given as a gift. When a person violates the non-aggression principle, they forfeit their right of property pursuant to their act of aggression. Law. The non-aggression principle, coupled with the right of property, are the only true law. It seems odd that people with such a simple philosophy would endure so much ignorant abuse by those who believe what they're told rather than seek the truth. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. A General Theory of Liberty, Tyranny, and Sin by Ben Stone. Disclaimer: because of the nature of the topic, allow me to be perfectly blunt so there are no misunderstandings to clear up later. I am not writing nor rewriting scripture. I am not establishing an edict, though I refer to the Christian Bible and both Jewish and Christian beliefs. This is not about any particular faith. An open-minded atheist should be able to see my point as easy as a theist. Finally, if your own personal faith is so dogmatic that you can't consider any variation from it, please read no further. Introduction. To understand any given discussion, it's necessary to understand the terminology being used. In this situation, I have chosen four words that can be and are understood in very different ways by different people. Therefore, it will be helpful if the reader is clear as to my intended meanings of liberty, tyranny, sin, and God. Liberty. A condition of freedom from control, interference, obligation, restriction, etc., or the power or right of acting, thinking, speaking, etc., according to one's own choice. Tyranny. A condition where an individual or group exercises domination over another individual or group using force or the threat of force. Sin. That which displeases God or is contrary to the will of God. God. That which created what is. Now, for this discussion, I don't necessarily refer to an individual person or entity. Therefore, the overall concept I'm trying to get across is not dependent upon a belief system like Christianity. God in this context can be whatever you see as the source of our existence. It fits the atheist as well as the theist. Liberty, tyranny, and sin. The beginning. The Judeo-Christian creation story basically goes like this. After everything else is made, God makes Adam and Eve. He places them in a perfect place called Eden tells them to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and he gives them only one rule, namely, don't eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Of course, they eat the tree, and sin is introduced into mankind's heart. God then rejects mankind from Eden. However, there's a gap in this story. From the point that God commands them to be fruitful and multiply, to the point that Adam eats the fruit, something must have happened. Some time must have expired, but nothing indicates how many hours, days, years, or eons of time pass. More on this later. What I propose to do is identify the fruit of that tree. What I will not do is dispute the volumes of traditional theological teachings about that fruit. So for the purpose of this discussion, please accept the possibility that I can be both right and wrong. God's will and sin. The Bible tells a story in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 8, and it goes something like this. After roughly 500 years in the Promised Land, the chapter doesn't actually record the time, you have to do the math separately, there was some unrest among the Israelite leaders. You see, during that time, they had no central government. A series of, quote, judges resolved disputes both within the Jewish tribes and with their neighbors. These judges had no authority in the modern sense. People sought their judgment in matters and voluntarily accepted or rejected the results. It was a time described in the Bible when, quote, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, generally speaking, the Israelites were free to come and go as they wished and trade with whomever they wished for whatever they wished. When the need arose to confront foreign aggression, the judges, being the natural leaders, would rally volunteers and fight defensive battles. Near the end of these 500 years of relative liberty, the Israelites began to murmur and complain among themselves. It seemed Israel was situated between several great empires. These empires had magnificent cities where powerful kings sat on thrones of splendor. Many of the Israelites became covetous of this power of these empires, so they demanded a king. The judge Samuel, at first, took this as a personal insult, but God corrected Samuel and said, "It's not you they reject, it's me." So after 500 years of liberty, Israel subjected itself to tyranny. To make a long story short, within a couple generations, the nation was split into two kingdoms, and a couple generations later, the northern half of the nation disappeared into the sands of time, never to be heard from again. Jerusalem, the capital of the southern kingdom, was sacked and burned. The male royalty were mostly castrated, and the bulk of the people were taken into bondage as slaves of the very empire they had envied. They wanted all the fun part of tyranny, but they ended up with what tyranny always produces, slavery. Now, isn't that a lovely story? Here's what I think. It's the same story as the one told in Genesis about Eden and the tree. It's just told in a different way, about a different people, in a different time. The interaction of law and sin. Here I ask your indulgence. Let's consider natural law as opposed to man-made law. Question: what is the source of man-made law? Answer: man. Question: what is the source of natural law? Answer: that which made man. Again, however you perceive God. If we can agree on the above, then we can agree that to break natural law breaks the law of God and is a transgression against God. Therefore, to break the natural law is to sin against God. That being the case, logic demands that whatever breaks man's law is a transgression against man. A, quote, sin against man. This train of thought then requires the question, isn't it the case that when man creates law, he takes on the role of God? Let's jump back to the Bible for a moment. In the book of Ezekiel, chapter 28, one finds the description generally believed to be the devil. Part of the description of this being says that he was, quote, perfect in beauty, gifted in music, perfect in his ways. And he was originally located in Eden. This being had a flaw in his nature, and eventually he fell from grace, was cast down and rejected by God. His transgression was that he attempted to make a god of himself. Now, does this story sound familiar? I propose this story in Ezekiel is in fact not about the devil. It is the story of man. It is the same story told two other times in this discussion. I propose that when man chooses tyranny over liberty, man chooses sin. That liberty is the original natural state of man, and when he takes it upon himself to regulate the behavior of other men, he places himself in the position of God. I propose that when Adam chose to make up his own law, he chose man as his God. He placed himself in the position of God and proclaimed himself a God. The end of time. Christians and Jews have a variety of beliefs about the end of time. I propose that time, as we normally call it, won't end in the way most Christians and Jews think of it. For this exercise, let's substitute the word history for time. Consider history from the moment God told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply until the moment Adam ate the fruit. Where is this history? Was there no time, or was there just no history? How many minutes or millions of years passed unrecorded? Now, think about history. What is history? I propose that history is the recording of the accomplishments and deeds of tyrants. When there are no tyrants, no history is written. Without tyrants, heroes are unnecessary, taxes are not collected, and wars do not happen. Time ticks on, but there's no reason to record anything other than the passing of seasons for the purposes of planting and harvesting. So what of the end of time? Well, change that to what of the end of history? Many religions believe that someday there will be a return of sorts to Eden. I believe tyranny and the law of man will be rejected, and humanity will choose liberty, and God's natural law will be universally adopted. That being the case, why would any history of that time be recorded? Time, in a way, will have ended. My Natural Progression from Libertarian Theist to Quaker by Ben Stone. I'll make every effort here to avoid allowing this to turn into a history lesson. Considering my love of history, that will be no easy feat. I will, at very least, need to give some historical background in order for the reader to grasp the depth of the connection between the origin of libertarianism and that of Quakerism. Murray Rothbard, maybe more than anyone else, has shown that modern libertarianism is founded on the thinking of a wide variety of historical figures going back to antiquity. However, libertarianism, as I see it, began to codify with late 17th and early 18th century English writers. I believe the desire for liberty at that time and place was sparked by the trauma of having seen firsthand the excesses of tyranny placed upon England by Cromwell and his Roundheads. The spread of Quakerism in England and in the American colonies, I believe, was a reaction to that same tyranny imposed by the religious arm of the Roundheads, the Puritans. That is to say, Puritanism, taken to its logical end, is a combination of religious, governmental, and societal tyranny, whereas Quakerism is exemplified in religious and societal tolerance, and its logical political end is the non-aggression principle, which is the foundation of libertarianism. To the degree that England and the colonies were subjected to the tyranny of Puritanism, the liberty-minded individuals were driven towards Quakerism and libertarianism. and as state begat state, as evil begats evil, when the Puritans fell from power, the restored monarchy and its parliament, invigorated by Cromwell's, quote, new model army, pushed free-minded individuals further towards libertarianism or Quakerism, according to their predisposed positions. Both libertarianism and Quakerism are radical reactions to oppression. By this I mean to say, if no one is oppressing you and you're free to go about your life without restrictions, religious, social, or political, you have a tendency to not think about liberty. It's like air. If you have all you need, you don't think about it. If someone takes it away, you quickly realize its importance, and you will react to that denial of air in direct proportion to the extent that it is denied. So, with the defeat of the English in the colonies, there was a loosening of the shackles of oppression, and likewise a relaxing of the impulse to abolish the state. Much like old Rip Van Winkle, libertarianism in the Western Hemisphere drank from the jug of complacence, sat down in the shade for a nap. The newly formed American government was, relatively speaking, held in check, and with more Western land becoming available, anyone feeling choked by the state could simply move away from it. Quakerism, however, saw no relief from the stranglehold of the religious ideologues. While the, quote, good religious folk of New England were denying property rights to natives, treating women like second-class citizens, and owning humans as slaves, the Quakers were pointing out this hypocrisy and proclaiming that all people were created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights. Eventually, like the libertarians, the Quakers found a degree of victory and became less important in America. However, unlike libertarians, Quaker ideas didn't get set aside. A far more dastardly method was used against Quakerism. The state feigned acceptance of Quaker demands by, quote, protecting the natives, reservations and handouts, quote, freeing the slaves, murderously denying secession, and, quote, empowering women, economic destruction requiring two incomes per family. At this point, we must turn away from history and clarify two words that I've been tossing around with careless abandon. What does it mean to be a libertarian, and what does it mean to be a Quaker? Both these words bring about almost instant confusion to the average American. Both conjure up inaccurate images that have been spoon-fed to Americans by the state through its puppets in Hollywood, the schools, and the media. Associating them with things they don't remotely resemble has systematically discredited both. So, to begin the clarification process, allow me your indulgence while I explain what libertarians and Quakers are not. Quakers. Quakers are not Amish, nor are they Mennonites. Quakers do not shun modern inventions like electricity and zippers. Quakers do not use buggies for transportation. Quaker men are not required to have beards, and Quaker women are not required to wear dresses styled in the 1800s. If you walk past a Quaker in a shopping mall, there would be no way of knowing the person was a Quaker. Just to make sure I'm getting my point across, Quakers are not Amish, nor are they Mennonites. And one last point. Quakers are not Amish, nor are they Mennonites. Are we clear on this? Libertarians. Libertarians are not dopeheads. Libertarians are not pro-dope. Libertarians do not want your children to have dope. Are we seeing a pattern here? Libertarians do not believe people should be able to, quote, do whatever they want. Libertarians are not liberal on some things and conservative on others. Libertarianism is consistent. Libertarianism is not pro-corporation, nor is it pro-business. Libertarianism is neither anti-corporation nor anti-business. Libertarianism is not, quote, against the Federal Reserve. Libertarianism is not, quote, for the gold standard. Often when a person attempts to understand another person's political position, they will ask questions like, do you support policy A, or do you think B is a good law? You can never come to an understanding of libertarianism by asking such questions, because libertarianism is not a political position. Libertarianism is a philosophy based on a very narrow set of principles. The more thoroughly the individual adheres to these principles, the more consistently libertarian they are. Every individual person, by the simple fact that they're alive, owns property. Their life is their property, and they can rightfully belong to no one else. Additionally, an individual owns other property that they have rightfully acquired through trade, by gift, or by homesteading previously unowned property. A person may defend their property, but no person or group of people can ever rightfully initiate aggression against the property of another person. Individuals are responsible for their own actions and cannot be responsible for the actions of others. This is the simplicity and the elegance of libertarian philosophy. Libertarians reject theft, aggression, and lies while embracing ownership, peace, and responsibility. There was once a person who taught just such a philosophy. The words he used were a bit different, but the meaning was clearly the same. He said things like, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And he taught us that God is not impressed with fancy costumes, titles of honor, or man-made authority, and neither should we acknowledge such things. So when I say that Quakerism, taken to its logical political end, is libertarianism, it's because both have the non-aggression principle as their foundation, and both promote an equal respect for individuals, recognizing that no human has the right to demand the servitude of another. In the old days, Quakers suffered many strikes of the lash for refusing to remove their hat or bow to state dignitaries. They caused a fuss by refusing to swear allegiance to symbols of those who sought deification by giving themselves such titles as Lord or Governor or Bishop. Quakers even went so far as to refuse to use self-glorifying titles and refuse to call others by them. Quakers felt no obligation to attend services or pay money to support buildings where men stood on perches and spoke down to their congregations. All these things were quite upsetting to those who did dress up in silly costumes and adorn themselves with ridiculous titles of honor. Oddly enough, however, to attempt to understand Quakerism by asking a series of questions like, "Do you believe in Doctrine A?" or "Do Quakers believe B?" is a misguided path that will likely never produce a consistent result. Quakers differ greatly in their individual beliefs. Some strictly believe in a particular version of the Bible, while others have a far less structured religion. Quakers are more defined by their actions than the particular details of their view of theology. Much like the non-aggression principle is to libertarians, Quakers adhere to something we call testimonies. An example of a list of testimonies would look like this: peace, equality, integrity or truth, simplicity, stewardship or sustainability. So, for example, a Quaker's testimony of peace is to refuse aggression. Many Quakers take their testimony of peace to the point of even refusing self-defense, but not all Quakers are pacifists. A Quaker's testimony of integrity is to refuse to lie. And this has caused some confusion in courtrooms when Quakers have refused to, quote, be sworn in. The Quaker contends that the very fact that they're speaking indicates they're not lying. And to repeat some magic words while raising or lowering one's hand or placing it on some object indicate that without such rituals, a lie is acceptable. So the, quote, testimonies of a Quaker are not simply words or doctrines. They are the day-to-day living actions of the individual. At this point, if I've done my job in a satisfactory manner, it should start to become clear why I say that Quakerism is the natural result of applying libertarian principles to theology, and libertarianism is the natural result of applying Quaker principles to politics. However, if you don't agree with me, I won't attempt to force you. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. one difference between a conservative, a liberal, and a libertarian. These are confusing times for label makers and label takers. In the 1980s, defining a conservative or a liberal seemed fairly easy. All one had to do was point at Ronald Reagan and ask, love him or hate him? Not a difficult task. But for some who looked very closely at the workings of D.C. in those days, defining a conservative was confusing at best and impossible at worst. Reagan's takeover of the Republican Party and seemingly the political right, along with his vast non-Republican support, appeared to signal a conservative victory in the war of political philosophy. When conservatives and libertarians heard Ronald Reagan say, quote, "In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem." And when we heard, quote, "This is the issue of this election, whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves." These words stirred the heart of every liberty-loving American. But there was a cancerous flaw in the Reagan Revolution. Because of this flaw, the more carefully you look at the goings-on in D.C. from 1980 to 1988, the fuzzier the definition of conservative gets. For the Reagan Revolution, its death began before its birth. Few today remember the hard primary fight Reagan had against his opponents, George H.W. Bush, Howard Baker, John Connolly, Bob Dole, and others, all hardcore right-wing statists. Few remember the harsh, hateful words that Bush would throw around at fundraisers and stump speeches, accusing Reagan of holding all kinds of crazy extremist positions. Few remember how Reagan nobly refused to sling mud at his fellow Republicans, no matter how vile they became. And fewer still realize that Reagan's winning of the Republican primary in 1980 was anything but a lock. The national convention was sewn up before it began, but the individual state conventions were politics at their worst. In the gap between the state conventions and the national convention, deals were offered and promises were made. The old right of the party finally gave Reagan a choice. Take Ford as your VP and appoint Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, and Alan Greenspan, Secretary of the Treasury. Or take Bush as VP and appoint his crew to the positions. Otherwise, face a fight at the National Convention. Reagan compromised his principles and accepted the lesser of evils. With that, the Reagan Revolution drank its hemlock before it cleared the birth canal. Of course, everyone spoke the conservative words of the Reagan Revolution, and some taxes were cut. The economy did recover by way of the typical bubble-making process so well known to those in the Austrian School of Economics. But Leviathan government grew at speeds never seen in a generation. D.C. essentially whipped out its massive credit card and bought a few years of prosperity. When the next big bust cycle hit, the Republicans were discredited. A half-liberal, womanizing redneck was able to point his finger and say, "It's the economy, stupid," all the way to the White House. In those years, the old right of the Republican Party entrenched itself, but with a new tool. The old right learned that if they spoke the conservative talk, they could go back to their compromising ways and work with the Democrats, and none would be the wiser. And thus they did until 2008, when the nation completed the task of tossing the bums out of power. This left a very confused body of faithful conservatives. Many asked themselves who they were and what label did they belong. The word conservative had been so completely polluted by the right-wing statists that its meaning was almost completely lost. Old-time conservatives were never afraid of a fight, but they were never warmongers. They always insisted on fiscal responsibility and were abhorred by national debt. How could the word conservative now mean endless war, welfare, expansions in Medicare, warrantless searches, forced national IDs, massive federal intrusion into local schools, and government agencies created for the sole purpose of spying on American citizens? conservatives began looking around, and they spotted a curiosity. Their old allies, the libertarians, had clean hands. Conservatives began to ask themselves, maybe I'm a libertarian after all. But they were wrong. Oftentimes, it's hard to tell who's a liberal, who's a conservative, who's a libertarian, and who's none of the above, but is a pure statist willing to sell anyone down the road for more power. The media, in its true evil nature, propagates the lies of the statists by focusing on the so-called hot-button issues, while pretending that statists don't even exist. The fact is, these hot-button issues are very important, but can easily be resolved using libertarian principles rather than choosing to believe the media lies and trust the state for the answer. For example, the quickest way for the media to discredit a libertarian is to bring up the drug issue. Some conservatives and some liberals will side with the libertarians in the fact that the war on drugs is a dismal failure and a massive waste of time, money, and resources. It's not hard to point to the prison system and say, all the king's horses and all the king's men can't keep drugs out of prisons, much less schools. Or just consider how difficult it is for a 14-year-old kid to buy a bottle of Jack Daniels compared to a bag of pot. Of course, a bag of pot is easy for a 14-year-old to buy, and that bottle of Jack is almost impossible for him. Funny how prohibition and black markets work, isn't it? But unfortunately, the cries of the bleeding hearts and the confused sheep win the day when whipped into a frenzy by the media and the statists howling their threats and spreading their fear that crazed drug fiends prowling the streets, raping and pillaging would suddenly overwhelm America if it were made legal. The facts don't matter when the media is involved. Only hype makes viewers stare at the stupid tube. But a subtle difference was missed in the above paragraph. Notice that some liberals and some conservatives sided with the libertarians, but they did so for practical reasons. The basic understanding of economics allows one to quickly see that outlawing anything creates a black market for it, thereby driving the price up dramatically and creating a money-making tool for criminals. But here the difference is missed yet again. These liberals and conservatives can clearly see the practical reason, but they miss the moral reason altogether. The consistent libertarians don't reject the war on drugs because it's impractical. They reject it because of their understanding of property rights and the proper function of government. The statists don't seek to perpetuate the war on drugs because he thinks it's winnable or because he thinks it's his moral duty to tell people how to live. He perpetuates the war on drugs because it increases the power of the state. The liberal and the conservative tend to look at the immediate cause and effect and support what they think will provide good results now. The consistent libertarian judges on a different scale. The libertarian philosophy is based on an understanding of natural law, property rights, and responsibility. As the libertarian applies these natural law principles to each and every aspect of life, it becomes easier and easier to understand how to live a moral life and how all of society can be free, peaceful, and prosperous. The libertarian doesn't seek to solve every individual problem in society because the philosophy of natural law will, by way of the invisible hand that Adam Smith wrote about, guide society to a solution as long as that society follows natural law. The statist will insist that only a powerful state can solve problems. The libertarian understands that to give any issue into the hands of the state will both increase the problem and increase the power of the state to further invade peaceful society. The libertarian understands that most, if not all, problems are caused by the state to begin with, and more state is not the cure. It's simply sugar-coated steps to slavery. So the difference between the conservative, the liberal, and the libertarian boils down to two things. One is the libertarian trust in natural law, and the other is the ultimate dependence on the state by liberals and conservatives. The libertarian believes individual issues like abortion, gun control, deficit spending, taxes, gay marriage, welfare, drugs, and even war itself all fade away with legitimate government and the abolition of the state. But as long as liberals and conservatives allow the media and the statists in the two parties to use these hot buttons to keep them focused on fighting each other, they will never open their eyes to the two massive leeches that have attached themselves to America's jugular veins, interrupting the flow of blood from America's head to its heart. One Republican leech on the right jugular vein and one Democrat leech on the left jugular vein, draining the American people of their wealth, their morals, and their children's future. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, property rights, go to badquaker.com, and thank you for listening.
How much tax is morally justifiable, by Ben Stone? It's the great question, and it's likely more important than you might think. How much tax is morally justifiable? Some people think that how you answer this question determines if you're a Democrat or a Republican. Some think it determines if you're right-leaning or left-leaning, conservative or liberal. In fact, all liberals, conservatives, leftists, rightists, Democrats, and Republicans answer this question with exactly the same answer. Question: how much tax is morally justifiable? Answer: enough for government to do the things I think it should do. Example: among other things, the right-leaning Republican wants enough tax to pay for a powerful military presence in hundreds of foreign countries. The conservative-leaning Republican may not see the need to occupy hundreds of foreign countries, but they do believe we need to have a powerful military in some foreign countries. The leftist agrees with both types of Republicans, but wants to occupy countries for a different reason with a different kind of military. The liberal may not be as comfortable occupying foreign countries and may want a much different kind of military, but he wants all that money and taxes so that he can fix the social problems he perceives around the world, and he's ready to use the military to do it. But they all want the same thing. They all want enough taxes to pay for government to do what they think is important, and they want everyone else to pay for it. The funny thing about this is that they all believe that these taxes should be collected and spent for their own moral-based reasons. This is statism. A person who understands the precepts of liberty sees this question in a completely different light. Question: how much tax is morally justifiable? Answer: there is no such thing as a morally justifiable tax. Tax is theft, and theft is wrong. When the statist reads this, his mind goes into a spasm. He leaps to the conclusion that you want anarchy, chaos, mayhem, a world without government, a world without leadership, complete breakdown of society. He imagines mobs of roving thugs destroying everything in their path. He can't understand how there would be roads, commerce, security, or any aspects of civilization without taxes, without what he perceives as government. Most of the time, when a liberty-minded person, a libertarian, sees this reaction by the statist, he attempts to calm the statist by explaining each item that can be done in a free market. Throughout history, roads have been built and maintained privately. People like Henry Ford were active highway builders prior to the U.S. government's seizure of the highway system in the 1920s. There was no income tax in America before 1913. Much of Europe had zero taxes throughout the Middle Ages, etc., etc., etc. This is a mistake for the libertarian. The libertarian is attempting to be rational and use things like facts and history. None of those things are important to the statist. The statist is driven by emotions like fear, while the libertarian is driven by a deep-seated desire for freedom and an understanding of right and wrong. It's not just an apples and oranges argument. It's apples and moon rocks. I've often wondered about how to bridge this gap and present liberty to statists in a way that doesn't send them into fits of wide-eyed chants of four legs good, two legs bad, USA, USA. I know a number of respected authors have written on the topic extensively, and I wouldn't be so bold as to think I could come up with something new. And I also realize that every statist is an individual and must be approached as such. Therefore, there is no one magic method. But one thing has been striking me of late. Morals. The leftist has morals. He doesn't want his income taken and given to some giant company that makes bombs that are dropped on wedding parties in backward countries. The conservative has morals. He doesn't want his income taken from him and given to a doctor who will then kill unborn babies. The leftist says the conservative is a fool. The conservative says the leftist is evil. Yet they're both making their arguments based on their own perception of morals. This is the crux. This is the keystone. The argument hinges upon their perception of morals. And ultimately, isn't the libertarian position also based on morals? So which set of morals is based on personal desire, and which set of morals is based on an unchanging principle? Which set of morals is ethical? How much tax is morally justifiable? Imagine the mafia provides you with protection, roads, discount mail service, medical care, emergency income, retirement income, and most all your earthly needs from cradle to grave, but with a catch. They can take as much of your property as they wish, at any time they wish. If you resist or try to escape, they will punish you, and if you resist hard enough, they will kill you. Is this a morally justifiable arrangement? How about if you're allowed to transfer to a different mafia? Would it be morally justifiable then? How about if the mafia allowed you to own land as long as you pay them every year, and if you stop paying them, they take your land, and if you refuse to leave, they can do whatever they need to do to remove you from the land, even kill you? Is this a morally justifiable arrangement? If it's wrong for the mafia, how's it right for the state? What magic does the state possess that the mafia lacks? Some would point to elections. But if Lucky Luciano would have been elected, and all other aspects of his life were the same, would we have a statue of him in Washington, D.C.? They have one of FDR, and he killed and robbed a whole lot more people than Luciano. If John Gotti would have been elected, would we have an airport named after him when he died? What did the Gottis do that the Kennedys haven't, other than the election thing? Are we to believe that the reign of the Bush family is morally justifiable, but that of the Bonanno family is not, simply because of the election process? Does the reader have that much faith in the goodness of his fellow voter? If 51% of voters elected the crime gang MS-13 into power, would their acts of violence magically become moral? So the conclusion that the libertarian comes to is that no arrangement based on aggression is morally justifiable. No association based on aggression is morally justifiable. A bird in a cage is captive. A bird in a larger cage is still captive. Give the bird a choice of cages, and it's still captive. A bird out of a cage but with its wings clipped is disabled but still captive. A bird trained to always return to its master is still captive, just uninformed. Folks, thanks again for listening to the Bad Quaker podcast. You can find us at badquaker.com. Our archive is there with lots of podcasts and lots of articles, both written and audio articles are available. There are also a number of interviews that you might find interesting. And be sure, as always, to give us some feedback either on the website or by emailing me, ben@badquaker.com. And as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.